This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is Sterling Allen, your host for this weekly program. You can go to freeenergynow.net to see our past and upcoming shows. Today, our guest is Ken Realm. Ken has been my right-hand scientific advisor for, a good 3 years or so. And Ken is also an inventor and has come up with some interesting concepts about how to extract energy from ambient heat, meaning room temperature heat or even lower temperatures that could be used for driving an engine. Ken, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Last July, you gave a presentation at the Salt Lake Conference, at the Extraordinary Technology Conference. Attended at the end there about this technology. You pulled together a PowerPoint presentation, and we have posted a link to that PowerPoint presentation on our site, linked from the freeenergynow.net under today's date, September 23rd, 2006. So somebody listening in on the archives or listening in live right now is welcome to go there and download that presentation so they can then basically watch along. Hopefully we don't lose people who are not watching along. We can give enough of a description of what we're looking at. But that will be helpful for people who would like to watch the PowerPoint presentation and flip through that as we go through this interview today. So Ken, tell us, in a nutshell, just give us an overview before we go into some depth here. What's going on with this technology?
Okay. The frontiers of thermodynamics are being expanded, working with at least one concept that just has not been recognized in years past. I basically have a recycling process for heat that is incorporated into an engine cycle that allows more heat to be recycled or recovered than what is conventionally allowed. Is that a good start for us?
Okay. I am actually myself at a conference in D.C. right now, the Conference on Future Energy that is hosted by the IRI, Institute for Renewable
Integrity Research.
I can't remember what it stands for, Tom Ballone's organization. And I'm on the cell phone. Are you hearing me okay?
I hear you, but your voice is weak.
Okay. I'm having a little bit of a hard time hearing you, so hopefully this isn't going to be too much of an impediment for technically for our interview today.
Mm-hmm.
You gave a presentation also recently in California, San Diego,
right,
at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. You gave a poster session in a session called Symposium on a Second Law. That organization, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, tell us briefly about that organization. What journals do they publish?
They publish Science Magazine. And the AAAS is just the large national, even international organization that is just a group of scientists who come together to share their work, and that's all that this meeting was. So the symposium on the second law of thermodynamics was like a class within the larger conference. This was a highly specific group of people that gathered from around the world, mostly university physics professors. Because it's a very highly specialized topic that few people would have that much interest in to present research papers on. And I was invited to this even though I'm not a university physics professor. But I'm considered to be a peer of those in many ways. And I've done some of the fascinating frontier work in this area that others have only been speculating about for a long time. I have actual experimental evidence which I demonstrated to the group. It was just a tabletop.
Yeah, you had a prototype of sorts that demonstrates one of the core principles of your concept.
Right.
Did you have that when you were working with Eugene Malouf, the late Eugene Malouf?
Yes, it was through the support that I received through his laboratory, New Energy Research Laboratory, that allowed me to build a test device and demonstrate it. And it was the preceding work for the publication of my research, which Gene published in his magazine, Infinite Energy. That's in issue number 51.
You also have a patent on this design, correct?
That's right. During the time at Gene's laboratory, we found some private funding to boost this work along a little bit. A private investor from France who formed a joint venture corporation with Gene's corporation, Cold Fusion Technology Incorporated, and the joint venture was called Cool Engines Incorporated. And I received a $50,000 infusion of money to get started in a contract that was supposed to provide $1 million over the next year. But shortly after this got started, 9/11 happened, which shook up world financial markets, and the investor in France lost his money, and $50,000 investment was all I ever got. Just enough to build one prototype that was reworked a couple of times into what I call the second generation prototype, but it was essentially still all the same. But it didn't quite work. I had problems with piston friction and poor gas seals that wouldn't hold pressure well enough to do the pressure volume work that was needed to run the engine. So all I was able to do was crank it over and get some measurements on it to show that, well, it's almost ready to work. And then the money ran out.
Well, let's go ahead and go into your PowerPoint presentation and walk us through that. And I will be the ears for those who, like myself, are listening in without the benefit of being able to watch along, because I don't have that in front of me due to the logistics of where I'm at right now.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead and dive into that. You do have a picture, if I remember right, of you with Eugene Malouf.
Sure. The first picture is with Gene Malouf. And this PowerPoint presentation was written specifically for the Extraordinary Technology Conference, although it's quite appropriate for this, most of it is very appropriate for this interview. So just to show the contact with those who have known Gene and what the free energy movement is about, I've been very close to that. Going on to
For the benefit of those who might not know Eugene Malouf, he was a primary proponent of cold fusion, kind of out there in front of that crowd with the peer review type of journal publications. There are, of course, a lot of people in that field, but he was a shining star, and he was murdered 2 years ago under circumstances that some people might consider to be questionable. But that point aside, he is a pillar in alternative energy technology, and you had the privilege of working very closely with him.
Yes.
So okay. Go ahead.
Let's move on to slide number 2, methods that circumvent the second law of thermodynamics. This is just to show that the research that I'm doing with my engine is not the only thing in this field, and to show that there are some legitimate research projects going on in this field. At least from my point of view, these are the ones that I have identified. First,
hate to break in here. Hate to break in.
Predicted this, but never was able to test it, and I was the first to test it.
Hello?
Demonstration of a kind of demon. I don't know if we have enough time to get into that or
this is Don.
Don, you're on the air?
Yes, I'm just trying to break in here for a second, only because we can barely hear your guest. Your voice is...
Hey, Ken, did you hear that? We can just barely hear you.
Really?
Yes. If we could just, because you're on the same line, if we could increase, if you could talk louder or closer to the mic or whatever you're using.
Okay.
Thank you.
Does it sound any better for you?
A little bit. I thought it was just my phone, but apparently it's your connection into the line is very faint.
Boy,
I should mention that at the conference here today in D.C., at the Conference on Future Energy, Tom Vallone mentioned that there was a publication in Physics Review B in 1999 that talked about an engine that was driven by the Casimir force. The last name on that was Pinto. Are you aware of that work?
No, I'm not aware of that.
I got the reference. I'll send a copy of that to you. But just to validate your point that you're not the only one working in this area and that this is something that is being pursued by some mainstream publications.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, keep in mind the Casimir effect is something totally different than ambient heat. That's the only
You're right. I was mixing that up. I apologize. That Casimir, I was thinking, was along with the lines of the Proella effect, but it's, that has to do with zero-point energy. So nix that. Sorry about that.
Okay, shall I continue with the list?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Just very quickly, Charles Steinmetz, who was a prominent engineer in the early days of General Electric, gave a paper that was published by General Electric about the atmosphere being a gravity separator of particles in the atmosphere. We don't need to go on to that, but that was a good mathematical expose of the concept of getting free energy from the environment by causing a separation of heat into hot and cold, which is basically what Maxwell's demon is trying to do. Then there have been some mechanical processes developed by others, particularly Herb Johnson, a retired mechanical engineer, professor of mechanical engineering from University of Colorado, I believe, in Boulder. He built a device that he presented to the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, and they threw it out, wouldn't even take a look at it, rejected his paper because it was just totally against what they believed. They said, that's impossible. You cannot do that. But I have seen his work and know that it's legitimate, whether the rest of the world knows it or not. The next on my list is physics professor Daniel Sheehan at the University of San Diego, who was the sponsor of this symposium back in June. Slide number 3 is a photograph that I took of him giving a presentation on one of his devices that he's just proposing, a solid-state thermoelectric device that is a combination solid-state electric and mechanical electrical generator. You may not see a lot of detail from slide 3, but this is not what we're focusing on today. We can go on to the next thing on the list. Another physics professor at the conference has a process involving superconductivity down at liquid helium temperatures. His paper was presented at the conference and very well received, professionally reviewed, and nobody found any flaw in his work. That was nice. Another one I have on the list is the research of Stephen Smith, which uses magnetism for a magnetothermodynamic engine that produces electricity directly from it, coming from the heat of the environment. And on that list that's given, slide number 2, there's a website given to see his work, worldwideweb.geocities.com/electrogravitics, and his work can be looked at on that site. Then I have another category called, two more categories. The last one's on the list. Asymmetrical atomic processes that involve infrared photovoltaics. We already have these devices in use in the world. They're called temperature cameras, and some of them are operated with photovoltaic devices, not photoresistive like the old light meters from 30, 40, 50 years ago that were used to cut camera exposures. And with these infrared photovoltaic devices, they're largely used for military purposes for heat-seeking sensors. They must be liquid nitrogen cooled to get any signal out of them. Otherwise, the visual screen of these cameras is just all noise, all white snow. And the reason for that is that those devices are converting ambient heat into electricity. And when the device is cooled, then what's coming in through the optics from it is actually looking at the focus path from way at a distance, the thermal signature. So this is prima facie evidence, a smoking gun, so to speak, that the heat of the environment can be converted into useful work, in this case, electricity.
I know on occasion in our news we will talk about different thermoelectric systems where they are using heat and converting it into energy. Most recently, there was a story out of Alaska where they're using some fairly low-temperature geothermal sources, like 150 degrees Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. and they're using that to drive an engine via a chemical that is able to expand and contract at those temperatures.
Yeah,
so there are a lot of technologies that are in the area of tapping thermoelectric or thermal sources, and maybe the difference between those and yours is your temperature gradient. How low could the temperature be and your system would still work?
It will work in Antarctic systems. As cold as any temperatures get on this planet, it will still work.
And so the quote ambient heat, meaning room temperature, could be the room, so to speak, could be in the Antarctica.
Sure.
One thing we should mention just as a context
anywhere.
Is, and I think this is fairly clear from what we've said so far, that you have been able to prove key elements of the technology, but you have not yet been able to get the funding necessary to build the first complete prototype.
That's right.
But you have built a prototype that was more crude, that was fairly promising. And if we could maybe jump ahead in the presentation, just to give kind of an idea of where we're going with this and what would be involved price-wise, just in the research and development phase. If I understand right, you're not looking at a lot of money to build an adequate prototype. Isn't it in the region of just a few tens of thousands of dollars?
Yes, and that's assuming that my basic needs are met. If it were just for the research itself, yes, that's all it would take.
And what about the device itself? How much engineering and the machine work, how much would that cost to do the proper prototyping?
Assuming that a couple of iterations would be required, it's in the $50,000 range just for parts, tools, and materials.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is minuscule compared to some energy prototype systems where you're talking maybe $1 million or even several million dollars. But go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Now that we have the background of just a few processes that supposedly violate the second law of thermodynamics, we can look at the superclassical engine, as I call it, based upon a new process called the Prohl effect, which is a newer, more complete analysis of what thermodynamicists call the constant volume process.
Spell that, the Prohl effect?
The Prohl effect, yes.
P-R-O-E-L-L.
That's right. The German word, that's actually pronounced Prohl, but we English-speaking people would say Prohl.
Okay.
So from slide number 10, there's a graphic description of the very simple classical understanding of the constant volume process, where heat goes in or comes out of a gas, and the temperature and pressure of the confined gas increases and decreases along with the heat that's taken out or put back in. Classical thermodynamics only recognizes this analysis of the constant volume process, which, by the way, is used in the Stirling cycle engine, spelled differently than your name, Stirling. You are S-T-E-R. The Stirling cycle is S-T-I-R. But we'll get to that in a couple more slides. Let me just give you the basics on...
One thing we might want to mention here, too, is, if I understand correctly, even though you're talking about an alleged violation of the second law of thermodynamics, that doesn't mean the energy is alleged to be coming from, quote, nowhere, but it's actually coming from a heat component that exists in the air around us. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. And so this is not an over-unity device by any means. It conforms to the first law of thermodynamics, conservation of energy, and we know where the energy comes from. It's in the heat in the environment. So when this engine works, the air around it gets cold, and work comes out of the engine because the engine is cold. And the heat just flows into the engine, which conforms exactly to the second law.
And so ironically, this engine could help reverse, if it were to be implemented on a wide scale, it could reverse the, quote, warming that has been taking place with what we've been doing to the Earth with
That seems to be, Sterling, but that's not true. Actually, it'll be a net zero balance because you'll be taking the heat out of the environment from the cold engine, converting it to work, and then work dissipates through friction and goes right back to the environment. You're back in the exact same circumstances that you were before. What blows the miracle circuit breaker of most people and all scientists is the belief that you use energy once and then you throw it away. That is not true, and there's no basis for that understanding. But global warming can be ameliorated by using this type of energy source where we no longer have to burn fossil fuels that will build up the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere any worse than they are right now. And maybe
and
with
one of the
energy,
things about this engine that
carbon dioxide
once
in
developed and fine-tuned is you could use it 24/7. It's not sun-dependent, wind-dependent. You can use it anywhere, anytime. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, let's take a quick look at the Pearl effect, slide number 11. This is a sealed system. It is constant volume, and it has some functional structure to it of a displacer piston and a regenerative heat exchanger that I just call a regenerator. And on one side of these devices that are connected mechanically and hydraulically in parallel, or pneumatically in parallel, one side is hot and the other side is cold. If we start off with gas on the hot side and then push it through the regenerator to the cold side by the displacer, what happens is that the gas that is left on the cold side is actually colder than the coldest temperature of the regenerator. And this is because of unrecognized energy flows that can be explained with classical thermodynamics. The details
that's not merely a function of reducing the pressure of the system, which would reduce the temperature.
The pressure will reduce when the overall mass of gas in the system drops in temperature, and that's why this process is used in the super cycle engine.
Okay. We are actually at the bottom of the hour.
Sure.
And we're going to have a quick break for Xenia's weekly insert about how we can reduce our energy footprint, a practical tips from one mother to the rest of us. Go ahead, Xenia.
Greetings, Sterling. Well, here are my weekly tips on how we as individuals can make a difference by taking action on global warming, particularly in our homes. Individuals can make a remarkable difference collectively by being informed and learning about the little changes we can make in our lifestyles and behavior. We can make big changes in greenhouse gas reductions and quit depleting the oxygen that we breathe from the atmosphere.
Hey, Jenny, we're having a hard time hearing you.
Pardon me?
We're having a hard time hearing you.
Okay, I'll try to speak up.
Now's
the time of year to winterize your home as cold weather approaches to see how to reduce your emissions and lower your energy bills by more than 30% by using energy more efficiently. So you can insulate your home with guidelines from EPA's Energy Star program. You can learn more about that on the website. Installing heat barriers placed above the insulation in your attic can decrease cooling costs by 15%, say about $30 a year. Repair the heating and cooling systems in the house by checking the air vents and ducts. Air escaping from ducts and vents can reduce heat, ventilation, and air conditioning by 20%. Sealing the seams can save about $260 a year. And if you use a duct tape to repair and seal the leaks, be sure to buy heat-resistance, high-quality tape to avoid cracking and loss of bonding. Also, your weatherizing project should include installing rubber gaskets behind electrical outlets to prevent hot and cold air from escaping through the outlets. And, of course, insulate your hot water heater with an insulation blanket, and also lower the temperature, even a little bit can save a lot. You may want to investigate into solar energy. Just the hot water solar thermal system will reduce your carbon dioxide emissions by about 720 pounds annually, and of course saves the energy bill. And if you're thinking of buying or building a new home, look for Energy Star certified homes that can save you the 30% a year. And you can learn more about Energy Star on the website, energystar.gov, G-O-V. Also, www.climatecrisis.com, Climate Crisis. That's from the Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And also, you can click on the Inconvenient Truth website and learn more. And I'd like to welcome the 4D group from Australia and the U.S. to the show today, and thanks for tuning in. A blessing to all.
All right, thank you, Zinya.
You're welcome. Enjoy.
Okay, Ken.
All right.
Let's go ahead and resume your presentation.
Sure. Let's go on to slide number 12. This is the opposite effect, the reciprocal effect of self-heating. First one was self-refrigeration. This is self-heating, where we start off with the gas on the cold side of the displacer and then push it through the regenerator to a higher temperature, and then it ends up on the other side of the displacer at a temperature that's higher than the highest temperature of the regenerator. In both of these cases, there is a transfer of energy that is unpredicted by classical thermodynamics. And just to give the readership or the audience some idea of what the heck I'm talking about, so it sounds like there's any truth to this, there is the gas on both sides of the displacer is doing work on the regenerator, or the regenerator is doing work on the gas to cause this extra heating or cooling. And classical thermodynamics has ignored that. And this is creating hot spots and cold spots in the engine that can be used for unusual energy flows. And that's exactly what I'm doing with my engine. Now go on to slide 13. This is a drawing of the tester that I made at Gene's laboratory and demonstrated at the University of San Diego to that symposium of physics professors. And since we don't have a lot of time, I'm not going to describe this in more detail so we can talk about the engine and its results, but anyone who has access to this PowerPoint presentation can go back and study it again and see more of what's here.
Yeah, and if we could summarize that, basically from what I understand, you have an electrode,
thermocouples at both ends to measure the temperatures, and I have a plastic sleeve inside the sealed cylinder that is a combination displacer and regenerator. The regenerator is inside a plastic pipe sleeve, and it's steel wool. And then there are some magnets that I use to couple to the movable displacer and regenerator to a ring of magnets outside the pipe so that I can keep the pipe completely and truly sealed. I just lift the magnets and it lifts the displacer inside and shuttles the captive air inside from one side to the other. So that's how it works. And I have an electric resistance heater on the top side of the displacer so that the upper chamber can be made hot and kept hot. It's advantageous with gravity in that direction, so there won't be convective losses to the bottom. Is that okay for now?
Yeah, let me just mention that when you gave this presentation in Salt Lake, you demonstrated in front of the audience, you had this all hooked up, and we were able to see your results as you produced them. You did a control where you lifted up the chamber in a control condition, and basically it was pretty much a flat line. There was a little blip when you first moved it, and other than that, it didn't move hardly at all. But then when you you had the system turned on to demonstrate the effect, the meter gave a very definite reading showing an increase. The line went, jumped up, and then it gradually came back down. And this is the presentation that you gave in front of these university physics professors
yes.
at the University of San Diego at this recent symposium. And that response from what you explained was very favorable, that they basically could not see any problems with your presentation and that, there was any holes in your logic. There were a couple of professors who were maybe a little bit perplexed and didn't know what to think, but you had a favorable response. Is that correct?
Yes. Most of them agreed with me, said it is exactly what I say it is. And of the only two that expressed any skepticism, I asked them, well, what do you think it is? And their reply was, I don't know. So that was a good review of the technology and the science.
And the upshot of that is that you had just demonstrated an exception to the second law of thermodynamics.
Well, this test actually is not an exception, but when it is used, when it is put into use and heat flows in and out of the Prohl effect, then it does violate the second law and entropy decreases.
Okay. So let's go ahead and you said you wanted to talk about the motors?
Sure. One more thing before we go on to the motors. Look at slide 14. This is a graphic depiction of a collision of gas atoms or molecules where the random collisions that we know of as heat can actually have a direction to go from one area to another. And if you look at the collisions which are going from left to right across the screen, relative arrow length is the speed of each particle. So it's sort of cold on the left side where the collisions start, and then it's hot on the other side. Heat has been transferred from a cold spot to a hot spot spontaneously according to the kinetic theory of heat. And this is what's behind the Prohl effect. Okay, let's go on. There are a bunch of graphs about my measurements, and this is displays of exactly what was demonstrated in Salt Lake City and in San Diego. People can study that afterwards after it shows off the air. And slide number 23 is the cover page of my patent, only to mention that it's there. And then several slides after that, numbers 24, 25, and 26 are scientific depictions of the cycle graphed as plots of pressure and volume. And this shows the different behavior of the Carnot cycle, which is the famous model that scientists and engineers base all of their designs and calculations upon. Then slide number 25 is the Stirling cycle, which operates over the same temperatures, pressures, and volumes as the Carnot cycle. And then you go on to slide 26, which is a nearly equivalent range of operating parameters for my engine, the superclassical engine, and that the black area between the curves is the work in one cycle. So though my engine has a smaller graph, it only means that it produces less work for the same size engine, but it's not an indication of efficiency. So slides 27 and 28, I can just see we're not going to have time to go into that in detail, but these are classically modeled concepts to try to prove or disprove that the second law can or cannot be violated by using a logical tool called reduction to absurdity, where they're giving an example here. These two are thought experiments of a combination of heat pump and heat engine, and can they work together in combination without any other outside influence? And the classical understanding is no, they can't, because these proposed systems won't work. They will stop. The slide number 27 would show the spontaneous movement of heat from low temperature to high temperature, and number 28 shows the complete conversion of heat at the low temperature in the example here into work. And in both cases, they say that's absurd because we've never observed these things before. Therefore, it must be impossible. But that's not good logic. Suppose some other conditions are discovered which go beyond the circumstances that have been known. And that's exactly what I have done. I have examples through the Prohl effect that I can apply to known mechanical thermodynamic systems to make an engine. And when you look at slide number 29, you see the first engine prototype that I built. And it's it has electric motors on it. It's a Stirling-type mechanical system with a power piston and a displacer. And you can always study that on the internet if you're not familiar with that. But what
that's
I have
the picture that we have at the beginning of this announcement about this interview, correct?
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
That's the picture that we have at the beginning of this announcement about our interview today?
One of those. I think that the announcement on Pure Energy Systems website is my second prototype. This is the first one, but most of the same parts went into it. I just made modifications to it.
Okay,
so this was the very first one, and the white plastic flywheel is the mechanism for converting linear motion of the pistons up and down into rotational motion of the flywheel with the intention of spinning an electric motor or electric generator. And in this picture, you'll see two tiny DC motors that I'm using both as starters and as potential generators. But it never developed enough oomph on its own to turn into a generator, so it was just a test bed here, a starter. But I have a battery running it and a bank of light-emitting diodes that has a display of NERL-PMM2, which are two acronyms for New Energy Research Laboratory, Perpetual Motion Machine of the Second Kind. And I was intending this one to work, and when it would work, I could disconnect the battery and the lights would continue to run forever. But there were mechanical problems, as I said. The piston seals had too much friction and not enough seal. Typical engineering trade-off.
Could we maybe go off topic, not off topic, but just take a little bit of tangent here and talk about, let's say that we had somewhat optimal conditions. You got the funding you needed to build a prototype, and let's say 4 years down the road, we've worked through some bugs. How much would one of these engines cost in comparison to, say, a comparable engine of comparable output? What kind of price point are you looking at? Are you going to be competitive with solar energy, not for the 24/7 aspect, because solar is only when the sun's up, but in terms of when the sun's up and the price point for how much a solar system costs, how would this compare?
That is entirely dependent on the economics of mass production.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like anything else. When calculators first came out, they were $300 a piece. Now you can get them for $10, and they have more functions. It's all the economics of scale. Now, to be fair to your question, so that you have something useful here, I would say that a 1 kilowatt portable generator made from this device would be several times larger than a 1 kilowatt portable generator that runs on a gasoline engine. And it would probably have a price premium of maybe double what current generators are. But this is anticipating a market of maybe 10,000 a year. When it gets into the millions, it'll be a complete replacement with no more costly economics than we have today. There's no high-tech stuff that goes
into this. That's the ballpark I was looking for.
I'm sorry?
That's the ballpark I was looking for, okay. Just an idea of how we compare. And I appreciate the candor, the reality that at first it would only be, the region of 10,000 a year before it got to the point where you could do massive production to bring the price down. And once you had the price down, would you be comparable to or could you exceed the price point of existing gas generators?
No, I don't think it will be any cheaper than the gasoline generators. It's low tech,
the difference
but it's
is that it's not using gasoline, and that it's clean.
Oh yes, yeah. It's the perfect example of a zero pollution device. You know, how harmless is heat? You know, our biological life has lived with it for billions of years. We know it's totally benign. There are no waste products from this, and the working gas inside of it can be air.
How scalable would it be? How small, how big?
The smallest I would imagine is probably maybe a 100-watt generator. It won't be small enough to run your laptop computer or your wristwatch. It will never be that small. And the upper limit is just the limit of piston engines. For example, maybe something on the size of a diesel locomotive or an ocean-going vessel that has a diesel engine. That's as big as they can get.
It's hard for me to imagine that you could get a lot of torque out of this thing without going very large. Is it conceivable that you could build one of these things that could run a car?
Oh, yes, but it will be a larger volume. It will not be as small and compact as we are used to. But just fill the existing engine compartment completely and solidly with engine, and that's all that it would take. You wouldn't need any airspace around it because it doesn't get hot and doesn't have to be cooled.
If anything, doesn't it run cooler than the air around it?
Oh, yes, and that will be the biggest engineering issue to deal with. How to get enough heat into it with enough power and still keep it small and effective.
Mm-hmm. Would it therefore be temperature dependent? Would it run better in a warmer environment than, say, in the Arctic?
Yes, it has the potential of running better in those conditions, but it can be designed so that it would run the same under a range of temperatures, and it really would be designed for the coldest temperature, and then you just regulate it. When it operates in higher temperatures. It's throttling, so to speak. Same concept of throttling.
Okay. So you're going to be adjusting some kind of a governor so that it's adjusting to the amount of heat that exists around.
It will adjust how much heat is allowed to come into the engine. At low temperatures, it's going to be running wide open, so to speak, to get the most power out of it. But when it's hot, say in tropical India or someplace like that, you're going to choke down the heat input to the engine just to make sure that the engine doesn't overrun itself.
Do you think that the strong push right now to develop alternatives would help accelerate a time curve of, say, the television, for example, from the time that Philo Farnsworth first came up with the idea to the time that first televisions were produced was like 20 years.
Right.
And then it took another 20, 30 years before there was market saturation. Would you see the time curve on the development of this being more or less than that?
It certainly can be less. It's all a matter of choice. Look how fast we decided to get to the moon. We did that in 10 years total.
So the main advantage here, even though the engine would need to be larger than a comparable gasoline engine, the advantage is that we're talking about a no gasoline.
That's right.
It's just basically, well, it's not basically, it's free energy in as much as we're not having to pay for the heat that exists in the air around us.
That's right.
Now, you, aren't you gradually working on a prototype right now?
I'm planning for it, but I'm not actually building anything yet. I have to amass a minimum amount of resources to do that. Otherwise, it's just waiting.
Right. Then every time you move, if you move, you're going to have to cart all your stuff with you, as opposed to having all the money necessary, and you can build it in a month or so. How long would it take you to build it once you had your resources?
If I could dedicate all my time to do it, it would only take a couple of months. But ideally,
and you
would
outsource some of the machining, of course.
Right. Ideally, I would have the help of a trained and experienced mechanical engineer who has better skills than I do. In a way, I'm just the inventor. I need some serious engineering behind me now. Sort of like the other inventors, they have their education in fields totally outside of the area that they're doing their inventing in. I'm a chemist by education. Formally, I don't
so
have
first,
the education
to make
it.
The first prototype would be a proof of concept. How long would it be before you were able to get it to the point where you could have your first practical application that could actually go to market?
That might be half a year.
A half a year after the first prototype?
Somewhere around there. These dates are very general.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be 1 month, and it wouldn't be 10 years. Somewhere in between.
You've had quite a bit of time to run this by various physics-minded people, professors, and whatnot. The entire concept, obviously, the patent office thought it was good enough that they put a patent. They
right.
awarded a patent on it. It's hard for, I would imagine it's hard for people to believe that we could actually have a functioning engine from the air, just the air that's around us, just from the heat that's within the air around us.
Oh, sure. Several hundred years ago, the people of the world thought that the world was flat. If I would have mentioned back then that the world was round, I would get the same sort of response I'm getting today, saying that the heat of the environment can run an engine.
Well, I imagine it wasn't too long ago that it would have been hard to imagine people walking around, each one having a cell phone so you can get reception most everywhere on the planet and talk to anyone anywhere on the earth with your own dedicated phone number through the airwaves and whatnot.
Oh, sure. That was Dick Tracy fiction just 40 years ago. You know, the two-way wrist TV, as they call it. That's virtually what we have today with our cell phones for all practical purposes.
Mm-hmm. Now, generally speaking, from what I understand, the time from first prototype to production prototype, which is something that could then be mass-produced, is not months, but actually 1 or 2 years at least. And that's, I guess it depends on the technology, but your 6 months would be definitely on the low end of the bell curve of how long it takes to bring something to market.
Right.
Not
That's
to
right.
market, but to the production prototype, which would then take, you know, so many more months to actually get it production ready.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is in terms of the in your doing business plans and whatnot that you've done to present this to various people, how much modeling has gone into the ramp up to production?
I have one business plan at this point for a different version of engine than what you're seeing on this slideshow. I have not had enough time to put into the development of this. I've all the all my time and effort lately has just gone into paying my bills, just like the average worker who works sun up to sun down just to make ends meet. That's where I'm at right now. I don't have time to work on my engine.
Mm-hmm. So let's say under nominally good conditions where you were able to get some money and able to produce. Of course, from what I understand from some conversations with you, you do have another business that you're starting up, and you're going to be obliged to carry that the distance, so to speak. So even if you were to get some sizable money, you would still need to be kind of doing two things, so to speak, wouldn't you?
Yes, quite possibly.
And so ideal circumstances, so to speak, in your case, would actually be slowed down a little bit. So if you were to get the funding, it would take longer, and that's why it would take longer, because you have some other obligations. Would you envision, let's say you got a functioning prototype, what then? Are you going to go tight-lipped and keep it to a very small group of developers, or are you going to go for more of an open approach, tell the world about it, and get a bunch of scientists working on the improvement and the tweak and the multiple? I mean, it would seem to me that there's a lot of engineering involved to go from the concept of, say, the internal combustion engine, for example. You look at how finely tuned that is nowadays,
right,
with the hundreds of thousands of engineers that have been involved in that. There's a lot of engineering hours that have gone into that. Wouldn't you imagine that something like this would benefit from the same type of engineering prowess?
Oh, absolutely. I get frustrated with potential investors who keep looking at my invention being able to give them a profitable, useful product in 2 years, and I say, wait a minute, the Wright brothers weren't able to produce a Boeing 747 from Kitty Hawk in 2 years, and that's sort of like what they're asking me.
Because this is a completely new area of energy. It's like, solar is one genre of energy. Wind
right.
is another genre. This is an entire genre of energy that has gazillions of shapes and sizes and modalities, and is just the very beginnings of emerging. So back to my question, let's say you get your prototype built and it works. You're able to show that this thing really is extracting energy and you have a, quote, self-runner. What then? Are you going to hunker down? Are you going to tell the world about it and kind of cut it loose, so to speak? You've got your patent to protect you to some degree. Which route do you plan on going?
I plan on opening things up for a total level free market. And in the very least, the patent is only intended so that nobody else can patent over me.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else can steal it. I do not intend to sequester it or hide it or strangle the world for a king's ransom for it. But a lot of what happens will all depend on the investors who come in and set up a legal structure, a corporation to take care of this. And then it's largely going to be out of my hands. I just have to negotiate very effectively in the early days of this so that I get the right people to work with me.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they can wrestle it right out of my hands and they can hold the world for ransom. That sort of stuff is common corporate practice nowadays. Just milk it for all it's worth, which doesn't mean that's the best thing to do for the world. Most people with money want to make more money. They're not interested in creating a better world. I'm looking for the few investors who do want to create a better world and want to truly invest as opposed to just make a money machine. We'll all do fine when all of this works. We don't have to worry about looking for the best advantage. It's growing out.
Well, Ken, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Our time is up. It's a good note to end on. Congratulations on such a forward-looking concept, and we wish you the best.
Thank you.